Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Fluke Hearing, featuring American-made products that provide hearing technology for every lifestyle and life stage, with 8 locations throughout mid-Michigan. FlukeHearing.com.
Welcome back to Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Great to have you along here on Tuesday. Crane's Detroit Business reports today that Detroit Tigers games have here at the halfway point of the season. Tonight's the All-Star game, of course, so we're halfway through the baseball season. The Tigers have the highest cable TV ratings in all of Major League Baseball. That's according to Fox Sports Detroit. That's the highest per game average cable TV ratings for the Tigers. And the St. Louis Cardinals finish in second place. But when you're the American League champs, I guess that's one of the benefits of being a championship team, I guess. But and Max Scherzer, of course, starts for the Tigers here tonight in the All-Star game. So we wish Max well. We have a great show for you lined up here today. At the top, backers of stronger early childhood education in Michigan were encouraged recently when Governor Rick Snyder approved a new state budget that increases early childhood funding next year by $65 million. The governor says the investment should reduce by half the number of preschoolers from low-income families waiting to get into Michigan's Great Start Readiness Program. Now, the governor and others support more spending to eliminate the waiting list altogether. That totals around 32,000 children. Tonight, Governor Snyder will attend a Lansing fundraiser in support of early childhood efforts. A growing number of education policy experts and elected officials of both parties appear to be supportive of strengthening preschool education, but beyond the funding, what other factors are involved in early childhood education here in Michigan? Joining us to help answer that question are Kelly Mix, an early childhood learning specialist at Michigan State University. Hi, Kelly.
Hi.
And Tanya Wright is on the phone with us. She is an assistant professor of early childhood education at Michigan State as well. Hi, Tanya.
Hi there.
It's nice to have both of you along. You two come at this from different perspectives, though, which is one of the reasons I wanted both of you on the on this segment. Kelly, why don't you briefly describe what you do exactly involving early childhood ed?
Sure. I'm a developmental psychologist, and my research focuses on how children learn mathematics, mostly in the early childhood period.
Okay.
Before I went into psychology, I was an elementary school teacher as well. But for the last 20 years, I've done research on how children learn in preschool.
Okay, very interesting. And Tanya, what about you?
My background is in early language and literacy instruction. I also used to be a kindergarten teacher and a reading specialist. So I really look at curriculum and instruction that supports early language and literacy learning.
Okay, very good. Let's assume for the sake of discussion that we have reached some kind of consensus here in Michigan regarding early childhood ed, and that let's assume that investment in it will continue to rise, at least modestly, just for the sake of discussion again. Beyond this financial investment, what other factors will determine whether it's successful? What do you think, Kelly?
I think it depends on how much support they give teachers who are actually working with children this age, and what they're going to use the money for. If teachers in the preschools understand enough about how children learn and what they need to know when they enter kindergarten. And I think it's actually a little controversial trying to figure out the best way to prepare kids for kindergarten, but we know that that's one of the main goals of early childhood intervention, is to make sure that all the kids enter school on sort of a level playing field.
Okay. What would that support look like then? How would we move closer to a level playing field?
I think that we need to do a lot more with teacher professional development for early childhood. I think Tanya can probably speak to this better than I can, but I understand that the The certification regulations for early childhood are not quite as tight as they are in K through 12, and that might be an issue.
Okay, Tanya, what do you think beyond the money, beyond the funding? What's going to make the difference?
Yeah, I agree completely, which is the quality of the programs, right? Just giving money to a program doesn't tell you what's actually happening between teachers and children in the program. I think we know a lot about what a strong program looks like. We know that teachers need to create a positive climate that's responsive to children. We know that they need to be able to manage the classroom in different situations when children work in whole groups, small groups, individually. And we know that they need to provide strong instructional support, so modeling high levels of oral language, being responsive in their feedback to children, and focusing on children's conceptual development. So those are some of the things that we're looking for, but it is going to take a lot of education, training, professional development to make sure that we have a workforce who are ready to provide that kind of program for children.
Kelly, can you describe for us the classroom behaviors that you are most interested in as far as either teachers or students are concerned? What are you looking for in a classroom of such young learners that gives you confidence that real quality learning is taking place?
You know, it's kind of funny because in my line of research, I look at how children develop number concepts. We know that teachers actually provide very little input on math or numeracy in preschool. It's surprising. And actually, parents provide pretty limited input as well.
What needs to happen then?
They need to start talking about number and math as a starting point. I mean, just having some input during the day would be helpful. When we look at parents who are working with their young children, they provide a lot of scaffolding. They take advantage of situations that come up to bring number into
it. What is that? What is scaffolding?
Scaffolding is when you see your child trying to do a task, jumping in just enough to help them get over, you know, get up to the level where they can achieve something, but not necessarily sitting them down and teaching them.
Interesting term.
If you're playing with your child, for example, and you say, oh, look, we've got 5 teddy bears, how many cups do we need to go get for them? That would be an example of taking advantage of a natural play situation, but bringing number into it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that happens very much right now in preschool.
What does happen right now in preschool?
You know, this brings up what I think is one of the critical issues in this whole discussion is that we know that young children learn naturally through play. And traditionally, developmental psychologists have told teachers of young children to focus on play, to have a sort of an unstructured environment where they can explore. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that. But we also know that in middle-class homes, children get input, and they need to have some input on math, and they need to have some input on reading to start to make sense of those symbol systems and start to gain those skills. So I think there's really a tension between kind of taking the K-12 approach and pushing that down into preschool and making it too formal and too rigid and focused on testing versus letting children play on structure.
Losing the play.
And I think that the key there is to teach teachers to be able to see those moments when they can jump in the child's natural play and take advantage of that to give them the input they need.
Tanya, what do you think?
Yeah, and I think there are also ways for teachers to really structure the environment or structure the play, you know, through appropriate materials to, you know, push children towards having those times when they can really learn. So I do think there's been some controversy in our field about preschools being too academic and not developmentally appropriate enough, and I think more and more what we're seeing is that we are able to, you know, do quote-unquote academic things like have young children learn early literacy, early mathematics, early science, and that these kids are really engaged in learning about their world, but in ways that are developmentally appropriate through play, through read alouds, so that they're learning something, but it doesn't look like a K-12 classroom.
No standardized testing, nothing like that.
Well,
that's an interesting issue.
Well, I think that's part of the controversy. There are some people who think that we should be doing standardized testing even in preschool as a way of actually, you know, it's not testing doesn't have to be all bad if it's defining a target and making sure that you're doing what you need to get kids where you want them to go. But the problem with testing in our educational system right now is it's so often used to evaluate teachers, and it's sort of punitive.
Yeah.
And no one wants to see that going down into the preschool. So, I would not say it's out of the question to see preschool standardized testing. I know that it's been in development for a couple of years now.
Briefly,
I think somewhat in use in Head Start, right?
Yeah.
Tanya, I'm curious what you make of Kelly's assertion that maybe there isn't enough emphasis on numbers amongst preschoolers. Do you tend to agree or not?
I think that's absolutely, absolutely true. not enough emphasis on numbers. We don't see a lot of emphasis on early literacy, although more so than mathematics and science, and especially very little science, which is a bit sad, right? Because little kids are so excited to learn about their world. And sometimes I think there's a concern that if we're helping kids to learn about whatever it is that they're interested in, the life cycle of frogs, we're becoming too academic. When I think in reality, that's the kind of interaction that goes on in homes where kids are successfully prepared for school, right? When the kid sees a frog, the parents are talking to the child about the frog and about its life cycle, about different types of creatures, taking kids to the zoo. So, in reality, I think those are exactly the type of experiences that we want children to have in their early childhood program.
That's just fascinating, though, the tension between the play and the more didactic approach to education, because there's the tension.
Exactly.
Right.
Right. And I don't think that anyone's advocating a didactic approach in early childhood, those of us who want literacy and mathematics. We're really advocating learning through play.
That might not have been the best word to use, but I think I think you get the idea. I've heard from both of you then that in one form or another, that early childhood teachers are less apt to have a college degree than teachers at other levels. Kelly, you suggested that arguably needs to change with this growing interest in early childhood. Are we moving toward a day when a degree will be required, or maybe at least the norm, Kelly?
Well, I would like to see that happen. I think that it's sort of a fallacy that early childhood education doesn't require a lot of preparation because they're young children and what they're doing is playing, and their conceptual development is at such an early level you don't really need to be prepared, when in fact I think it could be argued that it's the opposite, that a lot of what's happening in the early childhood period is pretty sophisticated conceptually. And if you can't see the nuances and what children are learning and what they need to learn, it would be really difficult to catch those moments and take advantage of them. So I think that early childhood education takes a great deal of skill. And I would like to see the educational system provide more support for teachers in developing that.
Tanya?
I think Michigan's Great Start programs are requiring a BA, or at least for teachers to be on their way to getting a BA. And I agree completely that teachers need a lot of training to do this really well. That said, I think the jury's still out on whether having a degree itself is what impacts teacher quality. I think it's more, right, because a degree could mean anything.
I agree.
But I think it's more what teachers learn to do as they get their degree that matters as to the quality of the program.
Well, this is a fascinating subject, and it's one we'll continue to watch very closely. It's one that Michigan State, of course, is pretty heavily involved in over at its College of Education. We'll also mention that about 200 mid-Michigan women will join Governor Snyder tonight here in Lansing for the annual Twilight Gathering fundraiser. If you'd like more information about that, visit womenscaringprogram.org for more information. And we want to thank our two guests, Tanya Wrights, an assistant professor of early childhood education at MSU, and Kelly Mix is an early childhood learning specialist also here at Michigan State. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. You can connect with us at currentstate at WKAR.org if you want to send us an email. The 34th Annual Ag Expo is getting underway at Michigan State University. When it's the hottest week of the year, you know it's probably time for the Ag Expo, right? It's a three-day outdoor farm show that organizers say is the biggest of its kind here in Michigan. To kick things off today, the MSU College of Agriculture and Natural Resources is releasing the first ever Michigan Ag and Food Index, or MAFI. The index is designed to gauge the business climate for agriculture and food businesses based in the state. Current State Scott Pohl went to this morning's Ag Expo kickoff breakfast to learn more about the Michigan Ag and Food Index from the director of the MSU Product Center, Chris Peterson, and MSU College of Agriculture and Natural Resources Dean, Fred Poston.
The MSU Product Center conducted a survey in April, getting responses from more than 100 farmers, food processors, and others, members of a new group called the Food and Ag Leaders Roundtable. By way of explanation, a rating of 100 would be considered neutral. Above 100 shows increasingly positive confidence, while a number lower than 100 would signal decreasing confidence in the business climate for farm and food interests. Food and Ag Leaders give the current business condition a score of 147, which seems to indicate optimism that is quite high. So Chris Peterson, you're director of the MSU Product Center. Would you say I'm reading that correctly?
You're reading it absolutely correctly. 147 is a very positive index number. This is the first time that we've run the survey. It's always nice when you're starting a new series of surveys to have such a positive outlook. And I think when you look around at agriculture and food interests, prices are very good. We have increasing global demand as well as strong local demand. It's hard to find a dark spot on the horizon at the moment.
I was going to ask you about what factors you might point to as possible reasons for such a positive outcome in this initial survey. Perhaps even the growing conditions this year might be a factor. You've already mentioned a few. Are there other factors we should consider when we're looking at these numbers?
Yes, I think this year's weather has been far more positive than last year, particularly for our fruit industries that had a sort of devastating year last year. They're looking like they're going to be especially strong. The great advantage of Michigan agriculture and food relates to all the diversity we have in terms of the primary commodities. So things are looking really good across the board.
Here's where we're going to get a little contrast to show how positive these numbers really are. For some contrast, the same index from Ag and Food Business Leaders puts their thinking about Michigan's overall economy at 116. That compares to 147 they have when they're thinking about food and prices and farming and so on. It's positive for the statewide economy, but much less so in terms of optimism that they feel about their industry. Why do you think that might be?
Well, I think the breadth of conditions that we're looking at in terms of both supply and demand are just incredibly positive. I know we have continued to struggle when we think most especially about employment in our state. Another set of questions that we asked in the survey did talk about employment, and the employment index stands at 132, and I think that's a testament to the fact that our industry participants really are looking to hire. Interestingly enough, the short-term perspective is a little less positive, and the three-year perspective is very positive.
We're also joined this morning by MSU College of Agriculture and Natural Resources Dean Fred Poston. I'd like to ask you what your plans are for using this survey within ANR at MSU. What's the future for this sort of work at your school?
Well, this is, in a sense, sort of the gift that keeps on giving. I'm very excited about it as we get 5-10 years worth of data and you can compare year to year. Chris and company can see the various things that are influencing this index, and I suspect he hasn't thought of all of them yet, so he'll have a chance to analyze that as he goes. But I think it's also extremely important to see that very positive index as we come out of this economic pit that we've been in. And I think the future looks bright. Michigan's a great agricultural state.
Now, you recently, within the last year, left a vice presidential position to become dean again, a former position of agriculture and natural resources at MSU. Did you sort of inherit this project, or was this some of your doing as you made this transition?
No, I walked through the door and Chris had to explain it to me. But as soon as it's one of those ideas that it's sort of deceptively simple, or it seems simple, it's not simple, but it makes a lot of sense after he gets through and you understand what he's trying to do with this. So I signed on wholeheartedly very quickly.
Now, the index scored three categories, and again, a reminder, 100 is a neutral score, and anything higher than 100 is positive. The sales outlook score was 125, the job outlook was 126, and investment opportunities were rated at 130. So all of those are looking good.
Yes, very strong across all three elements. I think what's very interesting in each of those cases, we also had a question that looked at the short term versus longer term. And investment looked especially strong in the short term, a little less positive in the longer term, and employment and sales both positive in the short run and even more positive in the longer run. So again, I think this sense of optimism that we see in the basic index is reflected in what people expect in terms of their sales growth, their employment growth, and how they're going to invest.
Now, amidst all these positive forecasts, what kind of concerns were raised by respondents this year?
Yes, we asked one question that essentially said, what keeps you up at night? And there is some considerable concern, particularly in the longer run, about labor conditions. Are we going to have the quality of workers we need, both for full-time jobs, but also for the seasonal labor pool that we have to have within our various industries here in the state? Major concern about regulation, and particularly food safety regulation. There is a set of new standards that we're all going to have to meet across the board in this industry. There are sort of the classic problems of strategy and customer needs and so forth. Government policy is a major concern, as would be access and the cost of inputs. So when you think about, these folks are very positive, but there are a few things that keep them up at night.
Are the Affordable Care Act and immigration reform also issues that are of concern to the interests that you surveyed?
Absolutely, because they fall into this general category of where will the talent for the future come from for our ag and food industries. Both in agriculture and in food processing, there's a considerable enhancement in the complexity of technology that needs to be brought to bear. And so anything that's going to increase the cost of labor is something that's going to be a major concern.
Can you tell me about the formation of this new group, the Food and Ag Leaders Roundtable? I assume it is a new group. What inspired that, and can you tell me where it might be headed?
Essentially, those of us who work with the food and ag industries here at Michigan State, we wanted to find a way that we could continually poll a critical group of leaders. And so we essentially set out with the goal to get roughly 100 leaders involved in the process. We have a number of producers that represent the diversity of the ag sectors in the state. Then we have a number of leaders out of the food and ag processing sectors, Plus then we have various commodity and trade executives who, in addition to understanding their members' interests individually, also represent their industries broadly. So we're very impressed that, you know, we're not just sort of walking down the street and picking anybody. We've got 100 people that are thoughtful about what's going on.
What happens next with these numbers? You release them today. What do you hope happens next?
Well, what we're going to do is twice a year, once in the spring before the planting season, once in the fall after harvest, we're going to go back to these same leaders, ask the same list of 10 questions, and going to continue to do that every year going forward. But in addition, in between times, based on the information we gather from this survey, we want to go back and talk much more in depth, but particularly about these concerns that they have. And we want to develop programs here at Michigan State so that we can respond to those concerns.
Fred Poston, are you thinking that the results of this survey as it goes on will help shape the classes that are offered within the college at Michigan State? Is there an academic response to this in the future, perhaps?
Well, I think yes. In the short answer, obviously, yes, it will. That especially along with some of the other surveys that Chris and the Product Center are running related to the demand for jobs and what skills are needed in agriculture. I think all of these are going to make a very good package, help us design where some of our academic programs should go.
MSU College of Agriculture and Natural Resources Dean Fred Poston and MSU Product Center Director Chris Peterson, thank you both.
You're welcome.
Enjoyed it.
Reporting from Ag Expo on the Michigan State University campus, I'm Scott Pohl for Current State.
WKAR, it's Current State. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore here at Studio S in the ComArts building at Michigan State University. Every year we're apt to buy the new updated versions of phones or computers and all kinds of other electronic gadgetry. So what happens with all the unwanted and obsolete items that we replace? Well, it becomes e-waste. And we welcome to the program Jim Grandholm. Jim is the founder of Green Earth Electronics Recycling. Jim, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
How much environmental threat does all this e-waste pose, or are companies like yours doing a pretty good job of recycling it all?
Well, we're making a small dent in a big problem that's a growing problem. I was just even looking prior to talking with you, but back in 2008-2009, a report on CBS News from the U.S. government, Natural Resources Defense Council, said that e-waste is the fastest-growing component of municipal waste worldwide right now. And back in 2009, the statistics said that we were throwing away, in the United States, 130,000 computers a day. Those were going into the landfills. And about 100 million cell phones were thrown away annually. So it's a big issue that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And we're making a dent, and others are making a dent as well. But what's great is even programs like this where you raise awareness, because what we're trying to do is keep things out of the landfills.
How are you making your dent then, exactly? What are you? You're recycling these items, is that it?
Well, we're doing several different things. Actually, as most know that know anything about recycling, the best way to recycle is to find a way to reuse. So the first thing that we're doing is trying to capture any type of equipment that may be obsolete, but perhaps it's something that could be upgraded or add new parts to and put it back in the marketplace. I was speaking to somebody just, I think it was yesterday, a 20-year-old, and I asked them if they knew what a typewriter was. And funny enough, they had heard of it, but they weren't really sure exactly what it was. Well, as I went on with the conversation, you know, I said, well, what do you, what do you use for, you know, putting together documents? Well, I use a laptop. I said, well, do you know what a desktop computer is? Yes, but that's ridiculous. They don't have one of those.
Wow.
And it's that's why it's the fastest growing component of municipal waste is because literally I don't know what kind of cell phone you use, but I'm guessing you use a cell phone. Years ago, nobody used a cell phone. They had pagers. Then before that, they didn't have anything. But the big craze was the iPhones. Well, when the iPhone 4 came out, you know, you'd see all over the news that the lines all over the place, people waiting in line for the iPhone 4. Offer an iPhone 4 to somebody this, you know, and they laugh at you. Well, I don't want an iPhone 4. And we're collecting iPhone 4s that people are wanting to dispose of because they don't want the iPhone. It works fine.
Yeah.
It still works.
Yeah.
But they want the next best thing. And that's why we have such an issue with it. Technology is changing so fast, and we get a lot of good equipment. So we're trying to find ways to use things. We collect so many computers that we can refurbish and redo something with. A desktop computer that literally now people that could never afford a computer. I mean, do you remember 5-8 years ago to buy a desktop computer was $1,000?
Mm-hmm.
And that's with a big giant CRT monitor. Well, now, you know, people couldn't afford that. So now what's happening is if we can do things right and continue education in that, people that never had a computer can at least now have a computer. It's not going to be the iPad. It's not going to be the top-of-the-line laptop, but they can get a desktop now computer and now get on the internet and do things they need to do. And, you know, it's good for students. So, you know, it's really a lot of education.
What can consumers do who are concerned about this problem? How can they alter their behaviors to improve this situation?
Well, you know, it's interesting because we do a lot of electronics recycling events, mostly in the mid to southwestern Michigan area. And, you know, basically people are afraid of it. I mean, we'll do recycling events and people will sit in their cars and they're afraid to get out. They're afraid to give us their things because they just know they don't know what they don't know. And so they're like, well, I shouldn't be giving this away because it's got information on it. And I go, well, you know, you're not storing information on your typewriter. But your computer, yes, it does have information. So literally, you don't want to just recycle it. You want to make sure that it's why there's a fear, and it's why there's kind of a lot of people hold back things is they just don't know what to do, and they're fearful of where does the confidential information rest, and how do I get that so that I'm protected? And that's exactly one of the services that we provide is we try to do everything we can to help put people at ease. I mean, we pick up a computer from somebody, we wipe the computers, the hard drives with a Department of Defense level wiping. We pick up and do a lot of businesses. We do banks and medical centers. Well, we'll take the hard drives and shred the hard drives so that there is no way anything could ever possibly be recaptured from that.
Okay.
So it's really trying to do everything we can to help facilitate and educate people, too. Because if they know that, hey, there's a comfortable place, this is a professional company or organization that's collecting this stuff and it's being processed, then people are just they get emotional at some of these recycling events.
Wow. We're talking with Jim Grandholm, who is the founder of Green Earth Electronics Recycling. My family's taken old computers and printers to a recycling event sponsored by our township. What typically happens to all that stuff?
Well, that's one of two things generally. One is the computer something that has any ability to be refurbished and used again? Like I said, maybe it's a low-end computer, but you can put a bigger hard drive in it, more RAM, and literally now provide it to somebody that can't afford a computer, and that $1,000 computer might, you know, somebody would be happy to pay $50 or $100 for it to just have a computer. But what we see is a lot of that is so ancient that what we do is we do the demanufacturing. We have a huge demanufacturing process. So what we'll do is you bring in a computer, for example, we will take it and start taking it apart. And if there's any components within it that can be reused, if the whole computer can't be reused, then we'll see if there's any components within the computer or any of the other electronics that can be reused. And then the rest is parted out and separated in the type of component in which it needs to be recycled. So that's where literally a computer, and it depends on who you speak to, but a whole computer going into the landfill, many consider hazardous waste. It'll sit there. There's no way that thing's ever going to biodegrade into the soil. But if you take the components out and then they get cycled, they can be recycled and made into new computers, and thus keeping as well a large volume out of the landfills.
What's at the top of your list of electronic junk that concerns you the most? What is cluttering up landfills the most?
Well, I'll tell you what the thing that concerns me, the biggest issue we have in electronics recycling right now is still what are the TV, the old CRT tube TVs, and a CRT monitor.
Really?
Which is not the flat panel monitor. They're the round, heavier ones. They weigh 20, 30, 40 pounds. But those actually have a lead that's in the glass. So those are considered hazardous waste if you open them up. As a component themselves, they're all right. But we don't want them in the landfills. We want them to be taken to a place where they are demanufactured, the lead is extracted, and again, the glass can be remade into something else. But if you take TVs and CRTs and start throwing them into landfills, I mean, you just got a mess on your hands.
Yeah, yeah. I ran into a guy on vacation years ago who was kind of a 21st century gold prospector, I guess. And this guy insisted that there is enough. This guy acquired discarded television sets and claimed that there was gold. there were some tiny bits of gold in these television sets, to the point where it made it profitable for him to actually acquire these things, tear them apart, and get at that gold. Is anything like that happening in this industry?
Well, that's what's really interesting is TVs, I'm not aware of having any gold. What they have, the commodity value that they have in them is copper. You have a cord that's got a little piece of copper in it. And on the back of a tube TV is what's called a copper yoke. Now, you get enough of those, and you can make a quantity of those. The copper is expensive, not necessarily gold. Now, we get this all the time. Computers are made with, there's precious metals in them. There's gold, there's silver, there's palladium, there's different things that have value. And the older computers, and which is why they were so expensive, had much more of it. Now, why is it that a computer that used to be $1,000 is down to $200? Well, it isn't because they've refined the process so much that there's less and less of those precious metals in them. But that's where, interesting enough, sadly, what we see is people going out and saying, oh, yeah, we recycle TVs and CRTs, and literally they will cut the cord off the TV, take a hammer, bust the thing in the back, get the copper yoke out, and go throw it in somebody's dumpster.
Well, so Jim, make a quick recommendation or two that might be overlooked by a lot of people as far as addressing e-waste and what they might be able to do.
Well, the first thing I would do is, like in the state of Michigan, is you can contact your county. Your county, somebody at your county, in almost every county that I'm aware of in Michigan now, has somebody that's overseeing the waste stream. And specifically, you can go we encourage recycling of everything, but paints, medications, everything, tires. But you contact your county and say, listen, where can I go or what do I do? A lot of the counties will say, listen, I live in Berrien County up here in southwestern Michigan, and Berrien County hosts several different recycling events where they will bring in people to handle all those things. So Lake Michigan College up here a couple months back had a huge recycling event of which we handled the electronics. So they had people there to take books. They took glasses. They took glass. They took styrofoam. They took paints and hazardous liquids. They took all those medications, and it was great. The line never ended. I've never seen anything like it. But people love the idea of disposing of things properly. So I would say contact, you know, your county and find out who it is or what options you have to recycle and make sure that you recycle it properly.
Yeah. Jim Grandholm is the founder of the Michigan-based Green Earth Electronics Recycling. Fascinating stuff, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you.
This environmental segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news on the Great Lakes environment is available at greatlakesecho.org. This past Sunday would have been President Gerald R. Ford's 100th birthday. He was the longest living and shortest serving president of the United States, with just shy of 2.5 years in the Oval Office. He was also the only president from Michigan. WKAR's Melissa Benmark spoke with James Kratzis, deputy director of the Gerald R. Ford Museum in Grand Rapids, to look back at Ford's life and legacy.
In 1974, when Nixon resigned, in the wake of the second biggest constitutional crisis in our country's history, and that is Watergate, this country felt down on itself, probably more so than any time I can imagine in my lifetime. Nobody trusted the government. Everybody was appalled at corruption. Everybody was appalled at what had happened in Washington, D.C., and that's August of 1974. Yet, in less than 2 years, we had the biggest party our country ever had. That was the bicentennial. I don't know how much credit you give presidents and how much blame you give presidents for any good or bad, but you have to give credit to Gerald Ford, who set the healing process from that resignation of Nixon to our bicentennial. And he started it by taking the biggest hit upon himself, and that was pardoning Richard Nixon. So I think we have to give him a lot of credit for not only saving our pride in this country, but also saving the presidency.
I know he took a lot of heat for the pardon at the time, but it sounds like, in your opinion, that it may have been the right thing to do to start the healing process.
Well, I was one who was very upset that he pardoned Richard Nixon. I think at that time, I didn't understand it, and I don't think it was made real clear to the American people that when Richard Nixon accepted the pardon, he also confessed his guilt. That's all anybody in this country wanted, was Nixon to say, "I'm guilty."
Just say it.
Just say it. And by accepting the pardon, he did. If President Ford had not pardoned Richard Nixon, that trial would have gone on for 2, 3, 4 years. And would we want to be putting an ex-president on trial during our bicentennial? I don't think so. We needed to move on, and I think President Ford did a very courageous thing to do that. He thought it was the right thing. Although many people at the time criticized him immensely for that, including Ted Kennedy and Bob Woodward. And since that time, late in President Ford's life, both Ted Kennedy and Bob Woodward said, "President Ford, you were right, and we were wrong." In fact, Ford, one of his prized awards that he ever got was the Kennedy Profiles in Courage Award, and that was for pardoning Richard Nixon. And Ted Kennedy said, "Time is a way of clarifying things, and Mr. President, you were right and I was wrong."
It's interesting because some of his public persona was that he was a fairly mild-mannered man. And yet, it sounds to me like in reading up on President Ford that he had a pretty strong will when it came to doing what he thought was the right thing.
Absolutely, he did. There were several instances where he did what he considered the right thing. It didn't matter what anybody else thought. I'll give you another example. Not long after becoming president, he announced his clemency plan for Vietnam draft resistors. And where did he make that announcement? He chose as his forum the National Convention of the VFW. It wasn't like he made it in front of, you know, on a college campus.
Right.
He did it right in front of the VFW, and there were not a lot of happy people on the dais behind him. But that was him. He always wanted to confront his critics. You know, he also did the right thing at the end of the Vietnam War when Saigon was collapsing. Congress refused to appropriate any money, and yet Ford ordered the evacuation of so many of the Vietnamese friendlies there. And he worked hard to get every one of those Vietnamese relocated in the United States, because countries like Thailand, Laos, areas in Asia would not take them. So Ford made it so that they would come to the United States, and he called in friends. That's why there's such a large Vietnamese community here in Grand Rapids, because Ford called in favors across the country, and naturally he called in his hometown, Grand Rapids.
A person has to wonder a little bit if his compassion might have been maybe directed a little bit by the fact that he didn't necessarily have the easiest early life. You know, people know that Presidents Clinton and Obama came from less than ideal domestic situations, but I don't think it's as well known that President Ford did, too.
President Ford was actually born Leslie Lynch King Jr. in Omaha, Nebraska. His natural mother soon was married to Leslie Lynch King Sr., who was abusive both physically and verbally. And it was just a few days after giving birth to the young Leslie that the elder Leslie came into the bedroom, you know, brandishing a butcher knife, talking about harming his wife and infant child. Well, the mother, you know, quickly got her newborn, traveled to Chicago, hooked up with her parents, who then they all moved up here to Grand Rapids. And while she got a divorce, you know, one of those rare things
right
back then, and she met Gerald Ford Sr., a paint salesman here in Grand Rapids, and young Leslie became young Jerry. And, you know, he did have a hard start of his life, but he was blessed with a wonderful stepfather and a wonderful mother who instilled all those values of hard work and telling the truth. And he always said there were three rules in his house: work hard, tell the truth, and come to dinner on time. And he said, woe be to anyone who didn't abide by any of those three rules. He actually had a very loving family, and it was hardship during the Great Depression, because his stepfather did not prosper during the Great Depression as so many others did. But, you know, young Jerry persevered, worked hard and playing football, worked hard at his studies, went to U of M, went to Yale Law School, and as they say, the rest is history.
Ford was a representative from Michigan's 5th Congressional District for about 25 years and was Republican minority leader for a while. What were his legislative interests when he was in Congress? What were his projects?
They mirrored what he loved as a president, what he loved in college, and that was economics. There was nobody who understood a budget better than Gerald Ford. He vetoed 66 bills while he was in the presidency. Most of them were spending bills that he thought were pork and bad use of taxpayer dollars. So in Congress, he was always on the Appropriations Committee. That was one thing. He was very big into Appropriations Committee for NASA. He was greatly steeped in the space program, interested in the military, but he, again, going back to it, he was always looking to cut, you know, wasteful spending by anybody.
After his years as president, what was he active in his retirement?
He was active in a lot of things. And it's very hard to talk about President Ford without talking about Mrs. Ford.
Right.
They were more than just a couple. They were, you know, that singular couple. They were one and the same. They were inseparable. So he worked, after the presidency, he worked a great deal to help the Betty Ford Clinic, Betty Ford Breast Cancer Awareness. But he also had his own personal agendas. I know he worked with Jimmy Carter on a number of occasions on supervising elections down in South America, Central America, and Africa. He had a lot of interest in that regard. But after so many years working, he enjoyed his retirement, too. He enjoyed golfing, and he enjoyed swimming every day, which he did almost every day of his life.
And he was the longest living president, so maybe we can learn from that.
Well, yes, you can. No two ways about it. It was amazing to me, even into his mid to late 80s, when he was standing, his shoulders were still rigid, straight back, just like you would expect from an athlete like him. He was always in great shape in his life, and like I said, he swam every day, I think, until into his 90s.
What do you believe the leaders of today could learn from his example, from his legacy?
Well, I think the biggest thing the politicians could learn today is his emphasis on bipartisanship. He worked very closely with both Republicans and Democrats when he was in Congress. There was a reason why he was chosen as vice president, because he was the one that could easily have gotten confirmation as vice president, and that was because he worked with both sides of the aisle. One of his best friends was later Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, one of the staunchest Democrats in the world. But the two of them just got along great. He was good friends with John Kennedy prior to Kennedy becoming president. He always worked well with both sides of the aisle, and he always wanted to work on compromise and team building throughout Congress to get things done for the country. You know, he doesn't get a lot of credit, but that's okay. Since President Ford's passing, there have been so many people who have said that he was one of the, maybe not one of the greatest presidents, but he was certainly great for what he needed to do and what he needed to be when he assumed that office after the trials and tribulations of Watergate.
James Kratzis is the deputy director of the Gerald R. Ford Museum in Grand Rapids. And for Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And a quick correction to our earlier statement, Gerald Ford was not the nation's shortest-serving president. He was, however, the only person in U.S. history never to be elected vice president or president who went on to become both. Coming up Wednesday on Current State, we discuss Waukesha, Wisconsin's quest for Lake Michigan water. Also, our Neighbors in Action segment features Eagle Vision. All that and more tomorrow. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org.